I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Louisa Wilcox, working for Natural Resources Defense Council, Sierra Club, Center for Biological Diversity, and Greater Yellowstone Coalition. Louisa has advocated for grizzly bear preservation for over 30 years. She specializes in developing comprehensive strategies that succeed because they work on multiple scales using various approaches, including grassroots organizing and outreach, education, media and communication, policy analysis, lobbying, coalition development, and public protest. She and a handful of others have, or had actually, prevented Yellowstone grizzly bear delisting for over two decades. This is what we're going to talk about today. Louisa has a BA from Williams College and a Master's of Forest Policy from the Yale School of Forestry and Environmental Studies. In 2014, she was given a Lifetime Achievement Award from Yale. So first off, thank you for your work, and second, thank you for being on the program.
Thank you.
Delighted to be here.
And so before we talk about delisting, we talked about grizzly bears before, but let's do a shortened version of how amazing grizzly bears are and then move from there to what's going on right now. So first off, what was grizzly bear range and population? Who are grizzly bears? What was their range and population prior to conquest? And sort of summarize the last several hundred years and bring us up to like 2 years ago before we move forward.
Okay, so before European settlers arrived on this continent, we had something in the realm of maybe 70,000 grizzly bears from the Mississippi River west to the California coast and from Canada down to Mexico in the mountain country, not in the deserts. And today, we only have 3% of what was here. 97% of the grizzly bears that were here were lost, were killed. Or their habitat was destroyed and developed. Those two factors. It didn't take Europeans very long, in fact, about 100 years, to smack down the grizzly bear populations across the country. I mean, they were well armed settlers with kind of a bad attitude when it came to predators of all stripes, and their mission was to dominate and multiply, and grizzly bears were in the way. Under the umbrella of manifest destiny, slaughter and genocide of Native peoples were acceptable and happened in a very, very short order. And grizzly bears now are relegated to five tiny, three tiny ecosystems in the Washington State, Northern Idaho, and Northwest Montana, and their strongholds are only in two places. All of these are isolated populations, by the way. The strongholds in Yellowstone with maybe 700 bears and in the glacier ecosystem abutting Canada with maybe 900 grizzly bears. And so grizzly bears were listed in 1975 under the Endangered Species Act. Without these protections, they would have gone the way of the rest of the 97% that had been extirpated. But grizzly bears was rescued from the brink of extinction by virtue of the precautionary principle codified in the law, the fact that the requirement of decisions to be made by the federal government based on science alone. And in the case of the grizzly bear, it's a very wilderness-dependent species. It needs large tracts of untamed country. We were able to protect these last great ecosystems and stabilize the numbers to about maybe 1,800 where they are today, but still isolated, still vulnerable, and now we have the threat of climate change, which is wreaking havoc on critical bear foods, as well as more and more people piling into these regions in northwest Montana, in northern Montana, and the Great Yellowstone ecosystem, so a lot more development occurring and further isolating and sort of putting a noose around these isolated ecosystems, potentially permanently. That's where we were this week, which is the last week of July 2017. We've seen the federal government again delist grizzly bears, remove their endangered species protections. This is going to result in easier killing authorized by the states of Montana, Wyoming, and Idaho, as well as a grizzly bear trophy hunt, which hasn't happened in over 40 years. And this is really premature. Population in Yellowstone is declining really pretty severely over the last few years relative to livestock conflicts and hunter conflicts, which is the direct result of climate change. I'll explain that a little bit more in a second. And we have on the horizon more and more foods being lost, potentially berries, the elk are in decline in the Great Yellowstone ecosystem, and it's just a terrible time to be rolling the dice on this remnant population.
So before we talk more about that, can you talk a little bit more about the habitat that grizzly bears prefer? Because my understanding is that, sure, they're in mountains, but they were also, they were in the Great Plains as well, and they were also in Santa Barbara, California. And so what do they like? What do they like? What do they eat? And before we talk about the decline of their foods, what are their favorite foods and what... So just tell me a little bit more about their preferences.
Sure. Well, grizzly bears will eat and do eat the same foods that we do. They love salmon in the Northwest and California. They were fond of bison, as we are and were. Native people certainly relied, and you've got these high concentrations of areas where people were in the Great Plains along the rivers and where grizzly bears were doing the same thing, trying to take down bison. And in the Southwest, you had bears doing what people were doing, which is eating acorns and manzanita berries and pinyon pine seeds. So pretty much anywhere that there were abundant human foods, there were grizzly bears in the mountain country and the plains. And those are the three big economies were the salmon economy in the Northwest into Idaho and down into California, the acorn economy, if you will, and the bison economy in the Great Plains.
And I just interviewed Stephanie C., and I've interviewed her before, too. And are grizzly bears capable of taking down a full-grown bison, or do they have to take on a weak one?
Grizzly bears are usually looking for, if it's an adult bison in a very compromised situation, if they're stuck in the mud or snow or something. But they can do depredate on bison. They're capable of it. They particularly rely, though, on other predators to do the hard work. Like, for example, in Yellowstone, where wolves have been restored, you've got instances where wolves will take down a bison and bears will then take it over. And bison really mattered to grizzly bears throughout the plains, and Yellowstone is the last place where you have grizzly bears, last place in the world where you have grizzly bears and bison interacting in anything like a natural way that serves the ecosystem purposes that, or ecosystem role that they played, for thousands and thousands and thousands of years. So you've got a very unique situation in Yellowstone, but we can't get away from our killing habits. We're killing bison and we're killing bears, and it's excessive, it's disgusting, and it's driven by this same old philosophy of power and domination over nature.
Right. And I don't mean to switch away from that, because I mean that's something I really focus on, but I also want to mention that we don't think about it so much, but don't bears eat just boatloads of grass and insects too?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, so not just going after these big targets, but they eat lots of moths.
Yeah. So when you think about it, a grizzly bear wakes up in the spring, March or April around here, and is on a race for calories to fatten up enough that they can go into a den in the winter and not eat, drink, defecate, and also the females produce young in the dead of winter. So they have to, grizzly bears really have to be beefed up. They basically have to be obese by the time they go into the den. And in order to do that, they're looking for every caloric trick in the book. They're looking, they eat ants, they eat hornets, they dig roots, they eat sedges and grasses and forbs and dig up pondweed in Yellowstone Park in the ephemeral lakes dried up, and they dig down into the rhizomes of this pondweed, and they are on the track of food, and that's what a mother teaches her cubs, is where to find it and when to put it there. And these cubs, that's why, you know, cubs are taught for 2 to 3 years by mom, and it takes that long for them to dial into a home range and what's in that home range and when to get what food. But grizzly bears are eating machines, and they have to be hugely fast to survive the winter.
And one last thing before we move on to the current delisting, and that's I just want to be explicit that when we talk about pre-conquest, what this says, and these populations pre-conquest, what that says is that humans and grizzly bears are capable of coexisting because they did for thousands and thousands of years.
Absolutely. One of the most common stories about grizzly bears, not just in the United States, but circumpolar, you know, so Russia, Canada, and, you know, Sweden and stuff, the grizzly bear was our kin. It was related to us. It was our mentor. It was our teacher. And we very much had perfected the art of coexisting with these animals. And almost, there's only a handful of tribes that hunted grizzly bears. Hunting black bears was reasonably common, but hunting grizzly bears was not, because these were relatives. They literally were our relatives. And so we coexisted with them. I mean, we competed with bear in berry patches with them, and, you know, probably dug pine seeds together, and were on the same salmon streams at the same time, and buffalo at the same time, and we bumped into these bears everywhere and pretty much made peace. We just decided when Europeans arrived with their attitudes and their guns that we couldn't accept these wild animals anymore, and we slaughtered them.
Yes, I remember reading an account of Northern California that prior to conquest, if you were near a river, you would probably see a grizzly bear every 15 minutes, which is about as often as you see a mosquito these days here. I mean, so seeing a grizzly bear would be like, you know, Junior says, "I saw a grizzly bear," and Mother says, "Oh, that's nice, dear."
Mm-hmm.
Did you see the sun too?
Right. It would have been an amazing sight to have been in any of these, like along a salmon stream in California, with grizzly bears and people and high densities of people too, and high densities of grizzly bears. So it was what a magical time that must have been. So we've had this relationship with bears. And bears have taught us a huge amount about how to nurture young. I mean, there is no more fierce protector of young than a mother grizzly bear. I mean, that's, you know, they can be trouble to people who bump into them with their cubs, but they're protecting their young. So they've taught us a lot and, you know, given us medicine. And they're still doing that. You know, if you go into Yellowstone Park right now, and this happened, I was just driving through last week, through Hayden Valley in the heart of the park, and there was a grizzly bear, and there was an unbelievable traffic jam. And there were spotting scopes out, and there were, you know, families out of their car, and car doors opened, and, you know, the sound of kids, you know, bubbling over, and, you know, huge lenses on cameras taking pictures. And they're after, still after the medicine of the grizzly bear. I mean, these remnant populations that remind us what the wilderness was in this country, and now only exist in places like national parks. But they're still giving us so much joy and replenishing our spirits, and not to mention the fact that wild grizzly bears and wolves and bison are huge economic draw, really the backbone of the economy in the Great Yellowstone ecosystem, as in Glacier. Is the natural beauty, it's nature. All of these counties are really dependent on both tourism and people who retire or move here because of the wildlife and because of the rivers and mountains and incredible wild places there are still to roam in.
So let's talk about the delisting. What can you give us a brief history on who pushed it, who is pushing it, how long they've been pushing it, why they're pushing it, and how they succeeded.
Right.
And also oppositions against it. We'll get to the efforts to oppose it afterwards.
Excuse me?
We'll get to efforts to oppose it, like the coalition you mentioned before. We'll get to that afterwards. So first talk about the efforts to delist.
Right. So the efforts to delist grizzly bears in Yellowstone or remove their endangered species protection started in about 1992, led by the state of Wyoming, which has the lion's share of the grizzly bears. And the state of Wyoming wanted to remove these protections at the behest of basically three communities. Hunters, which are their client groups, hunting licenses, paid the lion's share of the budget for the state wildlife agencies, including in Wyoming. So hunters, the agricultural community, ranchers, and energy and development interests. They wanted to basically make it easier to develop habitat by removing protections. They wanted to make it easier to kill bears with no penalty or legal consequence. We've got an issue with big game hunters running into grizzly bears over carcasses and facing the penalties under the Endangered Species Act, which are fairly stiff. The hunters didn't like this, so the hunters want to get rid of them. And you've got a market for trophy hunting of grizzly bears, where people again want to basically take grizzly bears for trophy. Of course, nobody really eats bear meat, and most of the trophy hunting that is occurring in, for example, British Columbia and Alaska is all essentially ego gratification. One could say, you know, men protecting, sort of their penis size through killing of large carnivores. But that's really what this is about. It's about state control over these animals working at the behest of various, you know, hunters and development interests. And so what's going to happen, so this week, it's the last week of July 2017, the federal protections have been removed. The announcement was made last month, and it just actually happened this week. And what we're going to see is more killing, easier killing with no adverse consequences of grizzly bears authorized by the state of Idaho, Montana, and Wyoming. And we're going to see grizzly bear trophy hunting. Maybe not this fall. We have not heard yet when it's going to be planned, but I would assume that either the state of Wyoming or Montana will move on this by next spring. And so it is being opposed. I'll get into it in a second. By a number of different interests and conservation interests as well as Native American interests, but those are the powers behind the delisting. And in this case, the federal government that has had authority under the Fish and Wildlife Service over the management of grizzly bears, the authority for the last 40 years, the federal government was in on the fix. The federal government was into and promoting delisting as well. And so the federal government just made this announcement.
Is this a done deal that there is no remedy at this point?
It's a done deal. Delist bears have been delisted. Now the only thing that can be done and is being done now is to sue the federal government, as was done 10 years ago when the federal government had tried earlier to delist grizzly bears. They were taken to court, and Earth Justice won on behalf of, I think, 11 conservation groups. They won at the federal district court and an appeals court to force the relisting of grizzly bears based on habitat threats and climate change. The climate change was allowing the white bark pine, basically promoting conditions where mountain pine beetles and indigenous beetles could basically survive in higher elevation areas where white bark pine, which produces a high fat feed that grizzly bears love and so do people. And we just lost about 85% of our white bark pine relative to an unprecedented climate-driven mountain pine beetle epidemic. And so that was why grizzly bears were relisted, is that this was underway, this epidemic, that the white bark pine was crashing, and we were able to convince the federal court, the judges, or the lawyers were, that there were still significant threats on the horizon and currently facing grizzly bears, and they were put back on the list. Now, the federal government basically has tried to paper this over and saying, you know, well, really the loss of white pine doesn't matter because grizzly bears eat hundreds of foods, and that's true, but they only, but that sort of obviates the point that there are only several, four key foods that are high enough calories to really drive the health of this population. Whitebark pine, army cutworm moths, cutthroat trout, and ungulates in the form of elk and bison.
And this is also just very clearly a death by a thousand cuts that mm-hmm. I mean, it's always, you know, when people complain about bears, for example, going to a dump, it's like, I have no doubt that if there were still salmon in the rivers, the bears would not go to the dump because they would rather eat salmon than somebody's leftover macaroni and cheese. Mm-hmm. But what are they going to do? I mean, I would go to a dump too if they took away all my primary food sources. And
right.
So the point is that this argument that, oh, that won't hurt them because the other things will make it up, it's like the other things are crashing too in many cases.
Right. Yeah. Or if they're not crashing, in the case of army cutworm moths, they will crash because all of the climate models show that this army cutworm moth that relies on alpine flowers for sustenance, the army cutworm moth habitat is going to disappear with climate change. 90% or more will be lost. So, you know, and the climate models are really consistent with each other. So all multiple foods are crashing. This is not the time to be, you know, rolling the dice and trophy hunting bears on top of already excessive levels of killing. And I should back up and say one thing, is that the grizzly bear has the lowest reproductive rate of any mammal in North America. So a grizzly bear female doesn't produce cubs till they're about five. Litters are very small, like, you know, one to three maybe in a litter, and they are produced every 3 years. And so a female has in Yellowstone, they live about 20 years or so in the wild, has a hard time replacing herself in the population in her lifetime. So you can't just go mow down these animals willy-nilly with such low reproductive rates. You can drive, I mean, we've seen what happens. When you mow down animals, we extirpated them once very, very quickly, and we can do it again. We certainly have the firepower.
So just to be clear, a mother has a baby in, what, January, December, whenever, and mm-hmm. then she comes out with that baby in this year, and then she stays with the baby all through 2017, and then does the baby sleep with her through that next winter? And then,
yeah.
And then, mm-hmm. So when the baby is a yearling, the baby is still with her? And then is
yeah, you can have bears that are 2 years old still with mom. That's really common. Even three is not unheard of. So, you know, they're hanging around mom, and then when she goes back into estrus in the summer, early summer, she'll and breeze again. She'll kick the cubs off.
And that's in that the cubs are going to be a cub born this year. That would be getting kicked away in 2019 or 20.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah. So they're a long time learning from mom how to make a living in the world.
And
sometimes you see a family group and the cubs are so big you can't tell which is the mom. I mean, you can tell them by their behavior, but you can't tell them by the size. They all look like, you know, kind of a little troop of bears running around.
And one,
they're all the same size.
One, I don't know if grizzly bears do this, but something I've seen here that just delights me no end is, I mean, I've seen this a ton of times, is the mother will eat something, and then she will call the baby over and breathe mm-hmm. into the baby's mouth, and that's how mm-hmm. she's telling baby this is okay to eat.
Right.
I love seeing that.
Yeah. And also you see the cubs adopting the same technique as the mom of excavating a certain food. Or, I mean, like you really see this on salmon streams in Alaska where the, you know, you've got the mom who sort of snorkels in for the salmon and then the cub learns the snorkeling technique and the mom who's a diver and the mom, you know, so you see all these different sort of strategies, you know, sort of replicated in subsequent generations bears, which is really, really cool.
So let's talk a little bit about, so who is opposing these, who has opposed this most recent delisting, and what mm-hmm. what is the opposition currently doing?
Yeah. So a variety of conservation groups have opposed, assiduously opposed delisting. Some independent scientists have also, including my husband, Dr. David Matheson, who used to be on the interagency grizzly bear study team here in Yellowstone. A number of other scientists, David included, have opposed. And also, we've seen this unprecedented coalition of Indians, of tribes, opposing grizzly bear delisting. 126 tribes had signed a treaty over the last year, plus to that would basically commit to the future of grizzly bears and more grizzly bears in more places, including on Indian land. And they're very opposed to the idea of trophy hunting because for them, this is like killing their relatives and putting their heads on a wall. So at the moment, the tribes are everybody's lawyering up. The conservation groups have their attorneys, the tribes have their attorneys, and everybody's heading into court at the soonest date possible to try to reverse this decision at federal district court.
And is in the meantime, are there timber sales or natural gas exploration happening? Well, I guess it's just this week. So are there, will they be able to get an injunction, do you think? Or do you think that terrible things will happen before they go to court?
The tribal attorneys and the conservation group's attorneys, there are going for a preliminary injunction. They are going to try to stop, this trophy hunt, which is being planned. And they're going to move as quickly as possible, but courts, are overloaded, and so it's a little bit unclear. I think the first big impact that we're going to see is that the states have been getting louder and louder requests from irritated ranchers because grizzly bears are turning to livestock, to cows, to replace the loss of the whitebark pine and cutthroat trout. They're actually turning more to meat, turning more to cows. And the ranchers are sick of this in places like the upper Green River area in Wyoming and want more grizzly bears killed. And that's the most likely immediate impact is at the behest of ranchers and agricultural interests. We're going to see more grizzly bears gunned down. And that could have an immediate bad impact, adding to the population decline that's already occurring.
One thing you brought up a minute ago, you talked about the white bark pine collapse, and you talked about that in the past tense, and is it continuing to collapse? Is it getting worse and worse?
Yes. The white bark pine is continuing to die. Nobody knows actually at what rate because they're not looking at it, at that problem ecosystem-wide, so it's the actual figures are unclear, but the below white bark pine, which is the highest elevation pine that we have in this ecosystem, you have lodgepole pine, which co-evolved with these mountain pine beetles. And, sometimes the beetle wins, sometimes the tree wins, but you've got an indigenous, you've got a built-up reservoir of beetles so that they're going to continue to send beetles up higher elevation. So this problem is not going to be worked out. You're not going to get to probably a steady state. Adding to the problem of mountain pine beetles in white bark pine is a disease that white bark pine gets called white pine blister rust. It's an invasive, exotic fungus that arrives from logging trucks from Canada. And so that disease is also taking trees out. They're sitting ducks. Essentially, we've lost this huge critical part of the Great Yellowstone ecosystem in the blink of an eye in about a decade. And it's not coming back. The climate conditions are not going to be suitable for a lot of white bark pine to regrow. Basically, white bark pine are expected to march off the tops of the mountains in the Great Yellowstone ecosystem anyway. So, this tree is a goner. In fact, one of my last projects I worked on for Natural Resources Defense Council was to try to get the Pitcairn Pine listed under the Endangered Species Act. And the Fish and Wildlife Service actually agreed with us that indeed this tree was endangered, but it was precluded by other priorities from Fish and Wildlife Service that it wouldn't give it protection. But they agreed with us on the science that this tree is really super in trouble.
So, sorry to grasp at straws here, but are there any predators who eat the beetles who might help a little bit?
Well, I mean, certainly woodpeckers and stuff. I mean, these beetles lay their eggs in the tree, and so you do have a certain amount of, you know, depredation by woodpeckers and the like, but they're not going to make a difference.
Right. Well, nonetheless, I will send out prayers for lots of woodpeckers.
Yeah, absolutely. And cold winters, we're just not getting beetles cannot survive a sustained cold period of say, -30 to -40, which we used to get, of like 10 days straight. They just can't survive, even protected in the cambium, even with the antifreeze that they put out to protect them. They just simply can't survive it. And we're not getting these kind of winters, but if we got some really big cold spells, it would knock the beetles down for a while.
Great. I will put that on the list too. So tell me more about this coalition of indigenous nations. That's you said the word unprecedented, and I believe you said 120 or 112?
126 so far, and still counting. I mean, there started to be opposition led by people in the northern Cheyenne tribe in Montana, which used to use Yellowstone quite a bit and travel through there and hunt in there. And they were upset because the federal government hadn't talked to them about the fact that they were planning to remove protections and the grizzly bears would be hunted. And so they were upset and began to send the word out. And none of the other tribes were really dialed into this issue. And the more that tribes heard about it, the more angry they became. And the federal government simply blew them off, assiduously blew them off for the last three plus years. And the tribal people wouldn't shut up. And so they've been going around and organizing, essentially classic, you know, organizing and outreach to other tribes. And now you've got tribes from Canada, the Piikani, which are part of the Blackfoot Confederacy. Both in the U.S. and Canada are opposed, and down to the Mexican border. You've got the Hopi and the Navajo and Apache in the Southwest. So everybody, all these tribes are rallying around the grizzly bear, not just in Yellowstone, but everywhere. And there are a number of tribes, including the Northern Cheyenne, Assiniboine Sioux, Blackfeet, Sales Chutney, that have a lot of grizzly bear habitat, you know, where they had grizzly bears, which and they still have suitable habitat. And so the tribes want to see more bears in more places, including on tribal land. And they want to roll in their management.
And that's what they're pushing for. Okay, they reproduce slowly, and let's pretend that this delisting problem went away. And let's pretend that, here's the question is, because they reproduce slowly, does that mean that they expand their range very slowly too? Like wolves, it's great. There are wolves down in California now. It makes me very, very happy. How long would it take if we left them alone for bears to re-inhabit California or to re-inhabit even the Kootenai territory?
Well, maybe I should get out of this question this way, that grizzly bears do move into new range very slowly, and it's really driven by the mother and her daughter. So the daughter grizzly bear will set up her home range near mom, in mom's home range, or next to it. So that's how you expand a grizzly bear population. I mean, these animals don't move like wolves do, or mountain lions do, you know, which can cover hundreds of miles relatively quickly in a matter of days. Grizzly bears do not do that. But These isolated populations, I mentioned the Greater Yellowstone and Glacier as isolated populations, grizzly bears have been moving west from Yellowstone and north from Yellowstone, as well as south from Glacier, and are tantalizingly close to reconnecting. This is just with 40 years worth of protection. So there was just a newspaper article last week about grizzly bears showing up in one of these outlying Yellowstone ranges called the Big Belt, which is directly between Yellowstone and Glacier. They're doing the connectivity thing. They are moving into suitable habitat just as scientists predicted that they could. They've been doing it very, very slowly. It's taken 4 years to get this close. But if you can reverse that by starting a hunt, which would result in killing, which will result in the killing of grizzlies on the periphery, as just as they're about to connect. So it's possible to see grizzly bears recolonize, say, for example, central Idaho, the River of No Return, Salmon Fellway country. They could get there on their own. They're starting to do it now. They're getting in from Glacier in the very northern end of the Selway-Bitterroot system, and they're almost at the edge of it on the east side from Yellowstone. So bears can do this if we let them. And they're good about, you know, investigating new foods and new opportunities. It just takes them a while, and they need full protection of the law. You just can't be going in and killing these animals willy-nilly.
So what is a typical range for a mother bear?
You know, 200 to 400 square miles. It's big.
And so when
in Yellowstone. And grizzly bears' home ranges very much depend on how rich the food source is. So in Katmai Park in Alaska, where their bears are eating salmon, you know, grizzly bear can make a living on just a few square miles of, you know, rich berry salmon habitat. But because bears are spread out here in Yellowstone, because the food sources are, you know, their home ranges are much, much bigger.
So when you say that the daughter sets up nearby the mother, that could be, that's you're not meaning she sets up 50 yards away. She could be 5 miles. How far would she set up typically?
Maybe a few miles. I mean, it depends on the food sources that the daughter has available to her too. But they're within their vernacular spitting distance of each other.
So they're aware of where each other is. The reason I was asking that is because I'm just trying to, if we figure 3 years for the baby to grow up a little bit, if they were a healthy population, we might be able to presume 5 miles every 5 years, so maybe a mile a year they could expand. Does that sound ballpark?
Well, I'm not sure I really know the answer to that. Cubs have a high rate of mortality in cubs.
Right.
You know, these are, when cubs come out of the den, you know, they're 20, 25 pounds, you know, and mom has to make sure that they can swim the river. Sometimes they drown, and, you know, cubs get eaten by male bears. You know, infanticide is known and documented in grizzly bear populations. So there's lots of ways of cubs dying, and about 50%, roughly 50% mortality you can estimate in the cub population. So it depends on, you have to grow those cubs, you have to have them survive, and you have to have them move. They've expanded, let me just think about that. They've expanded maybe 50 miles, about 50 miles in Yellowstone to the west. I mean, on the very far end of the Centennial range now. So that's, you know, 50 miles in 4 years. So. But, you know, it depends on the quality of the habitat they're moving from and into.
Can you tell me the population, total population again of grizzly bears in the United States?
Yeah, there's about 1,800 grizzly bears now centered around Yellowstone with about 700 and Glacier with maybe 900. And then the Northwest Montana Kamiak population, Selkirk, populations in North Idaho have maybe 30 bears each, and then in the North Cascades there's a tiny, tiny remnant grizzly bear population in Washington State abutting the British Columbia border, and they haven't even seen those bears in years, but they estimate that there's maybe five or so.
So this is one of the things that kills me about all this. I wrote about this in a book on zoos years ago, and how terrible zoos are, that they killed a mother and then put her babies in the San Francisco Zoo because she ate some corn in a rancher's barn. Seriously, that's right. It. And yeah. I did the math, and it was like, they ate a bag of corn. I can buy a bag of corn at the feed store for like $15. And even if we expand this to killing a cow, it is so absurd and obscene to me that you're going to kill a creature when there's less than 2,000 of them or 3,000 of them. Mm-hmm. You're going to kill one of those because it killed a cow of whom there are, you know, I don't know, billion. I don't know how many cows there are, but a lot, and isn't even worth that much.
Right.
Never mind the fact that the cow was probably on public land anyway.
Right. It was about 400,000 cows in the Great Yellowstone ecosystem. That's a lot of cows. And, the value of a female reproducing female in an ecosystem in the wild is inestimable. I mean, when you figure out all the strikes against these grizzly bears and against growing up, and a female who's not only is able to reproduce and replace herself in the population is inestimably important. And to let a grizzly bear die or be killed because it invaded somebody's corn or ate a cow is really, we've got our priorities backwards, you know.
I mean, it just has always seemed to me that if there are only a couple thousand of these, then you certainly cut them some slack. I mean, if there were, you know, a million grizzly bears in Yellowstone Park, you know, forget the fact there couldn't be because of carrying capacity, and mm-hmm. then one killed one of these, whatever you said, 400,000 cows, then we could have a discussion about this. But it's just, mm-hmm. it's absurd to have a creature with a low reproductive... I'm not telling you anything you don't know. This is just it makes me so angry that I mean, just at the very least, just pay for the damn cow and be done with it. You know, it's like right. you were gonna sell the cow to be killed anyway. So what do you care how you get the money? It's just ridiculous. I'm wondering to know about that is because of the whole thing with wolves where they'll pay double value for a wolf mm-hmm. kill if a cow kills a wolf on public lands, no less. They will pay double the value. It's like, if I was a mm-hmm. rancher, I would be praying for the wolves to kill my cows right. so that I can make more money.
Yeah, and that may be happening now in Wyoming. Same thing is true for grizzly bears. There's a really high value that the state pays out when grizzly bears eat cows and stuff, and it appears that at least in this upper Green River area, which I mentioned earlier, ranchers are basically letting their sick cats die so they can get reimbursement. It's easier for them rather than doctoring their cats to just let them die and then they get reimbursed. And that'll continue the payment claim.
And meanwhile, go ahead. Sorry.
No, it's just truly outrageous. I mean, just for perspective, about 1,800 bears, 1,800 bears in five populations. The scientific community basically says it's not recovered. You know, that recovery really does look like 2,000, 5,000 grizzly bears. Some scientists actually say more. And the only way you can get to that is through connecting Yellowstone, which has been isolated for over 100 years, to other grizzly bear populations. So, you know, it's not recovered. And to give a perspective on 1,800 a different way, there are in Romania about 6,000 brown bears, which are grizzly bears. Romania is like the poorest country, one of the poorest countries in Europe, and last fall in 2016, they stopped trophy hunting of grizzly bears at 6,000 bears. And they're mostly that population centered in the around the Carpathian Mountains, which is about the size of Greater Yellowstone. And it's like, wait a minute, if a poor country like Romania can, without complaining, support 6,000 bears and then stop trophy hunting so they can potentially, you know, even grow their population further, what is the matter of with us in the United States that we can't sort of, be man enough or brave enough to support more grizzly bears in more places?
So what is wrong with us?
We're selfish. we're violent, and we don't, and we're not patient. I mean, we can learn, and plenty of people do learn, how to live with grizzly bears who are ranchers. There are many ranchers, actually, in Yellowstone and in outside Glacier Park, along the Rocky Mountain front, that are doing just fine with grizzly bears. They don't necessarily want a lot of press for it, because the stock growers would chew them out, but they actually are coexisting. But there are many who don't want to, and it just takes a few, you know, really aggressive thugs to, you know, reverse, you know, the hard-fought recovery that's taken us 40 years to accomplish. So, yeah, I think we are still very much, as a culture, oriented toward power and domination over nature, despite the fact that I think culturally we had second thoughts, and which meant that we passed the Endangered Species Act to protect imperiled species. Despite the fact that the wilderness, we passed the Wilderness Act to protect the last remaining wilderness. So we're kind of schizophrenic at this point. You know, we recognize we may have gone too far, and yet the thugs are in charge of government now. Certainly the Trump administration has put into place leaders in Interior, our former Congressman Ryan Zinke from Montana, who is a pro hunter, is a hunter himself, yeah, trophy hunter, became hunter, and adamantly supports, you know, hunting grizzly bears. Yeah, so the thugs are in charge now.
I want to go back to the corn. We have just a couple minutes left. I want to go back to the corn for a second, and and just think about, I mentioned before we turn this on, and longtime listeners know that I see black bears almost every day here. I see a mother and a baby, and it just every day in the summer. And it delights me, and it makes my life better. And this is not without cost. Last year, there was a mother and two babies, I think, and one of the babies decided it was fun to chew on tires. And so I had to replace my tires on my truck. I had to replace three different tires, three different times.
Or wow.
A total of three tires. And
wow.
The first time was like, oh, that's so cute. That's a nice price. And the second time, I'm like, oh, you stupid bear. And the third time, I put some nail strips around the truck. And the point is, and my mom's, the frame on her house, the frames around her doors have been chewed up by the bears. And the point is, we don't care. I mean, that's the price you pay for living in their home.
Right.
And I would think that losing a bag of corn, or losing a cow, or losing some chickens, or whatever it is, I mean, that is your sacrifice to the grizzly god, you know? And my tires last year were the sacrifice to the black bear gods. And it's just, it's like, this is the price you pay for living in their home. This is my rent. That's what I'm trying to say. This is my rent.
Yeah. I mean, that same thing. Similarly, we live a mile from the wilderness in north of Yellowstone Park, and we have goats. And several years ago, a mountain lion killed two of our goats. And we actually weren't at home. My husband was studying mountain lions. And we were gone, and the house sitter said, you know, what do I do? Do I call the state? It's like, no. You know, these lions, our goats are lion food now. That's it. You know, we're not going to ask the state to trap them or kill them or anything. It is the price we pay, or should pay, for living in some of the last habitat for these large carnivores that really don't have a lot of places to go as we cram more and more people into this country. We're sitting on the last refuges, and so the least we can do is afford some losses in terms of animals that we grow or vegetables that we try to grow if they get into our gardens and stuff.
So, last question. This is a temporary done deal, at least, but what can people do to support the efforts to relist?
Yeah. So right now, it would be support the attorneys, Earth Justice, Wilders Guardians, the tribal, the attorneys for conservation groups, the attorneys for the tribes, who are being represented by Frederick Peeble Morgan, a law firm out of Denver. I'll post something on my website, so I'll get contact info. And support the Endangered Species Act. I mean, right now the Trump administration and Department of Interior are trying to gut the Endangered Species Act, and Congress is sharpening its knives. The point is that the Endangered Species Act works. And 90% of those species that are listed are still with us because of ESA protections. And if the ESA goes away, we will further extirpate species throughout this country. And we don't have to, and we shouldn't. I mean, these are other beings. These are part of creation. And we, I think, as a people, need to respect the rights of other things to large mammals and tiny little frogs and plants. Respect the rights of these other species to coexist, to live on the last places where they do.
So the very last thing is what is your website for people to go to?
Yes, it's www.grizzlytimes.org. And I've just gone through a revamp of the site, so there's a lot of info up there now. I mean, there was before.
Well, thank you so much for your work, and thank you for being on the program, and I'd like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Louisa Wilcox. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.